Hey, Propagandos listeners, this is Production Alec. What you're about to listen to is the first part in what's probably going to be a two-part series with Nate Smith. We had him on to talk about two films about Mormons, produced and directed by Mormons. And the conversation was so good that I don't really want to cut it down to like 1 hour and 30 minute episode. So instead, you're going to get like the first half today. And then in a couple days, hopefully I'll edit down the second half where we talk about the second movie. So please enjoy this first part, this lengthy meandering discussion about Mormonism and the film God's Army. And I'll see you on the flip side.
Is that Jack Mormon? Is that what the phrase that I picked up?
I think
up?
Jack Mormon.
Yeah, so Jack Mormon is like somebody who still keeps themselves on the roll, but like drinks and smokes and doesn't go to church. I joke about like ethnic Mormon because it's like, this is every ancestor I have from like 1840 on in this one area. You can't really be like ex-Cajun. Right. Like,
yeah, it's not a religio ethnic group. Yeah. All the stuff that you say about like, Jews and ex-Jews and I don't know if they have.
Yeah, I kind of nicked it from the Jews.
Yeah. Non-practicing Jewish people, right? Like you're going to have the same stuff.
It's funny you mentioned ex-Cajun because like, I think I'm the closest to ex-Cajun and Alec is like LARPing as a Cajun.
Do you have family? Either of you were.
I guess I'm, what is it? A revert, right?
Like revert,
I've come back to the fold.
Yeah. So I was born in Lake Charles and Alec and I grew up in Texas. And then now Alec lives in Lake Charles and I never left where we grew up. So, well, I might need to switch
to a more accurate. I was just thinking of like a group of people inside of the United States that form sort of like an interconnecting societal bonds and at least somewhat protected by the elements, right? Because part of the reason I would think that Cajun culture survives is just how like uninhabitable Louisiana is.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Nothing can kill us.
hold on. I mean, Cajun exists kind of in the same funny way as like Utah, right? It's inhospitable land. Nobody wants it. There's this, let's say, odd differentiated ethnic group that lives there. That's kind of internally coherent.
Also defined by like coming from a certain part of Europe, largely too, like
Canada Mormons, mostly.
Yeah,
Canada.
My family.
So Mormons mostly come from Northern England. Like that is the vast majority of like were baptized in the 1830s and 1840s in like Birmingham when they were getting pushed off. A bunch of people getting pushed off of their farms and into factories. The third way is Brigham Young and Parley Pratt coming in and saying, "Let's go build Zion in the West," and a lot of people took them up on it. So
I mean, as a lot of religions, but especially as a specifically American religion, it's very funny in the way that it begins, as a lot of these do, as an emancipatory utopian cult, right? It's fighting against all the things that kind of Americans propose to be the things that are wrong with America, right? And there's nothing more American than that, right? The entire American project is people spinning off of Europe and then the United States in different ways to go west to forge this proposed utopia. And then, of course, even the Mormons, right? They never have their they never create their Utah and Rhodesia. They end up
Not quite. They're able to figure out a system for about 50 years of frenemy status with the United States that ends up being what keeps them from getting kicked out again, right? But like talking about the utopian thing, yeah, like if you look at the 1830s, the Mormons are even kind of like late to the party a little bit. But that's when you have like Robert Owen doing New Harmony. That's when you have the Oneida Colony, the Shakers, you know, just that second Great Awakening. It is real. And, you know, for as much as people tend to want to put it all on one person or one origin with Joseph Smith, it really is stuff from all of the groups and what was in the air coming together. Because from the moment the Book of Mormon is published, Joseph Smith's in charge, but he doesn't have the full control. There's other preachers coming into the fold and building it up.
The thing that I'd say is odd about, I guess, modern secular analysis of the Mormon faith is exactly that kind of misunderstanding, right? Where for a secular person, the easiest thing and the most ready thing to critique are the actual religious beliefs, the doctrine of the church, which is, you know, I mean, you're an ex-Mormon, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a Catholic, right? The book ends up being a very small part of what social mores and kind of norms, right, that actually dictate your day-to-day life end up being, and can actually be in quite serious conflict with the text, right? So analyzing the text, analyzing the story of Joseph Smith and the seer stones and, you know, Moroni and all this stuff doesn't really give you a holistic understanding of what Mormons are now, certainly, and probably very little even understanding of what they were when they started, even.
Well, there's a world of difference. And this is, you know, obviously these are two movies that take place in sort of the modern Mormon experience. But there's a world of difference between the church as it was in 1830 when it was started and in 1844 when Joseph Smith dies. In that 14 years, they go from being Trinitarian to non-Trinitarian, Universalists. The Book of Mormon explicitly condemns polygamy. By the time Joseph Smith dies, they're secretly doing it. Like, there's a lot of journeys that people go on, influenced by the events around them, too.
So, if you're listening right now, you're wondering, what is all this Mormon talk? Have the propagandos lost it? Are they religious now? No, dear listeners. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Propagandos. It is Saturday, August 3rd. Connor here, joined by Alec, as always. And we're talking about Mormonism because our guest today, Nate Smith, has recommended two movies of Mormon cinema for us to watch and review. And we've got God's Army and Brigham City, both directed by Richard Dutcher. Nate, thank you so much for these recommendations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for watching them. I've been trying to make every non-Mormon that I know watch these because I think that they're the best encapsulation of Mormon culture that you're going to see in cinema.
Modern Mormon culture.
Of modern Mormon. And, you know, honestly, Mormon culture as it was in the year 2000.
Yes.
It's already quite different than it was back then.
I think it's also crucial to point out that these were made by a person who, at the time they were made, was an active member of the Mormon church. Like, this isn't like you're under the banner of heaven through a critical lens. This seems to be like an internal critical lens.
These are movies, I think, very much made by Mormons for Mormons. Although I think most of the cast of God's Army is not Mormon at all. They're just actors in L.A. Brigham City is where you see the character actors that pop up in like shows like Touched by the Angel and Everward that were shot in Utah. And I think you can see the step up in acting between the two.
You know, interesting. I mean, Dutcher, speaking about, you know, his faith and his background in the films, if I'm reading between the lines about his biography, I mean, part of his reason, because he eventually leaves the church, right? And he's, I believe, still essentially not a practicing member. Or there's some title that they give him, basically, I'm leaving, but I'm not super mad at you guys, so maybe I'll be back, right? I'm not writing this whole thing off, but I can't be, in a Catholic sense, you'd say, like, I'm not going to be able to take communion for several years. So I'm just not going to bother, right? Just don't call me Catholic.
Yeah. I would say, and I don't want to put words in Richard Dutcher's mouth, other than that his like open letter where he said that he was stepping away from the church was a big earthquake for me when I was in high school, because he was a really big, well-known local celebrity. I would say I put him in the same camp as me at this point, where I'm kind of increasingly saying post-Mormon rather than ex-Mormon, where it's like, I'm not like embarrassed by this stuff. And I feel like a lot of what I'm trying to do is like take what I learned and graduate and move beyond it. I've listened to a couple interviews with him in the past year, and I get the sense that that's where he is. He's been experimenting more with like mainstream Christianity too, trying to like find the spiritual spark that I think he had when he made these movies, and probably, you know, has struggled to recreate since he left the church.
It seems like the film actually had something to do with that break, right? Especially given the period that he makes it. We might talk about later, but there's a forbidden text that is impossible to find, right? His 2008 movie Falling, which apparently is quite good, but you can't get it anywhere. And it's at the same period where he leaves the church.
Well, the even more hidden text, but the even more hidden text is after Brigham City, he had Larry H. Miller, the owner of the Jazz, gave him $10 million to make a biopic of Joseph Smith. And he signed Val Kilmer to play Joseph Smith.
Wow.
Which sounded like it would have been amazing.
Yeah. And I do wonder if getting into the weeds on church history probably, because then instead of that, he ends up making a second God's Army movie, which, spoilers alert for God's Army 2, States of Grace, ends with one of the main missionaries sleeping with a girl, getting sent home and trying to kill himself before he goes.
God.
Because there's a famous quote that a a leader of the church named N. Eldon Tanner would talk about how when he left on his mission, his dad came to him and said, "I'd rather see you come home in a casket than come home dishonored." And that was a thing that gets repeated. So that one made people mad. That one, Brigham City, I think people were, Brigham City was darker than the Utah public wanted it to be. I would argue it's honestly darker than Silence of the Lambs.
So let's give a brief introduction to these two films. Connor,
So God's Army takes place in Hollywood, California, and I believe this movie came out in 2000. So this movie came out in 2000, and it is about a group of Mormon missionaries living in LA. And there is a new missionary that joins the flock, and he's got his own troubled past. And over time, you are introduced to the slew of characters, some more important than others. Some bring something to the table. Some just are there to play pranks and laugh. But each one kind of displays what it means to have a crisis of faith. Each character has their own crisis of faith. And it's very nuanced. It's not just like everyone has, there's one flavor of having a crisis of faith. Dutcher really shows off what it looks like for different people in the different circumstances. And it comes down to race. It comes down to doubts of the church, doubts of the history of the church, doubts of yourself, doubts of the sins of the father, that kind of thing. And it's really compelling. And it's all about their misadventure that they try to convert everyone from sex workers to crippled people. And
they're on mission, right? So they're living in a shitty little apartment together, right? I think six guys, basically. They're multiracial in a very kind of 90s way, right? There's a black guy and a Latino guy, and you know, and then a couple white guys with different backgrounds. They eventually meet an Asian guy is one of their a key feature of the kind of later part of the film, a kid that's interested in Mormonism that they end up converting, basically.
Yeah.
In the nomenclature, they call those investigators.
People investigating the faith.
Yep. Somebody who's considering joining the faith as an investigator.
It's a fun dive into Mormonism, at least for the fact that you get introduced to all these internal terms, right? The missionaries are elders.
Yeah.
The girls are sisters, right? Which that's kind of a core.
Right out the bat, our main character, whose name is Elder Allen, played by Matthew A. Brown, who shows back up in Brigham City. Elder Allen mentions that when he's talking to the president of the local...
he's the mission president.
Mission president. The mission president points out, "Oh, your dad's in prison." He's like, "That's stepfather." And the mission president says, "You've been sealed to him, so that's your father, basically." And I wrote that down, like, ask Nate what sealed is.
Yes. So this is actually something that Richard Dutcher is true of Richard Dutcher. The way Richard Dutcher came into the church is was born not in the church. His mother got divorced from his father, married a Mormon man named Dutcher, who then legally adopted him and was sealed to him, like inside the temple to be like his son. Like it's like a religious ordination.
It's a consecration.
Yes. Bindings that happen inside of the temple are supposed to exist beyond the veil of death. So if you marry someone in the temple, you were married to them in the afterlife. Whereas if you just marry them legally, you go your separate ways in the afterlife. So that would also be like a similar thing. Although in his case, his stepfather molests children, Elder Allen. I don't know what the story is. Richard Dutcher, he is not, it was dark on that level. He has not said that publicly, but before we jump in, one thing I really want to hit that I think God's Army does very well is demystify something that is very strong in Mormon culture, which is the mythos or almost like the cult of the exceptional young man. So it's like Joseph Smith, you know, supposedly sees God when he's 14, starts writing the Book of Mormon when he's 19 or translating, depending on your narrative there. So he's very young in that. The first narrator of the Book of Mormon is Nephi, who's also an exceptional young man that goes and does the right things. Mormon himself, who's the compiler of all of this scripture and the Book of Mormon is named after, is like his path. Basically, he's like basically like Nephite Marcus Aurelius, where he was like chosen when he was like 12. Right. And then in Mormon history, you see stuff where there's a lot of pioneer stories about, there's a famous story about three teenage boys that when they're trying to cross the Sweetwater River in the winter, that they go back and forth and carry all the infirm so much that they all are like deeply like damaged by the end of it. And supposedly Brigham Young wept and said that their salvation was assured. that no matter what they did for the rest of their life, that act alone. So there really is this thing of like the perfect missionary goes out, behaves well, knows everything at 19, and goes out and gives it. And I think a lot of times in Christian movies, that character, like you're thinking like God is not dead. The Christian kid in God is dead, not dead, does not learn anything the entire time.
He doesn't need to.
Starts right, and then everybody comes around to his rightness. Whereas I think especially like Elder Allen, he doesn't really have like a fight. He's on his mission because where else is he supposed to go? His life has fallen apart. It's like a mission, or he could have joined the military, or he could have maybe tried to go to college, but he doesn't seem that like academic. And there are, when you're out on your mission, there are a lot of those guys that are just out there because that's where you're supposed to be right now.
It's a period in your life where you're undergoing this rite of passage as opposed to doing something else, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And he's not from Utah. He's from Kansas.
Critically.
Right? So I think that's another thing. I think God's Army is a very interesting movie that is about Mormonism outside of Utah.
Yes. When Alec and I were talking about it, my main thesis of the film is that both of these movies, Mormons dealing with the outside world. This one is Mormons in the outside world, and then Brigham City is the outside world coming to the Mormon world. This one seems to, you know, there is some drama in it for sure, especially the big reveal of Elder Allen talking about his stepdad being a child molester, and then Richard Dutcher's character having brain cancer. You know, that's a big one. But for the most part, these are pretty lighthearted movies. The soundtrack even made me feel like, oh, this is a 90s movie. This is very much a 90s film.
Well, God's Army is a lighthearted movie. God's Army is a lighthearted movie.
Yeah, yeah. Brigham City, not so much. But yeah, I had a lot of fun watching this. And as I texted out, I was like, this is incredibly compelling. I did not expect it to be so. As hokey as some of the acting is, I really, really appreciated the script. And I remember getting a little frustrated when Elder Banks he's a black missionary, and they go to try to I don't think that these characters are investigators. It sounds like they're just like actively trying to make a pitch to them. But this black couple that keeps pointing out the racist history of the church, and Elder Banks does say like, yeah, I, you know, became a Mormon before I knew about all this stuff. And when I heard about it, I certainly felt kind of weird. But then I felt the spirit of God and I believe it to be true. And as frustrating as I found out, Alec pointed out to me, that's how it happens.
There's a lot of people like that. We had black missionaries, black convert missionaries in my mission. You know, like that. This movie is how I found out about the temple and priesthood ban. I was 10. I had not.
Really? So that's not common knowledge.
Well, it's common knowledge, like, but it's there's a lot of things inside of the church, especially when like with dark past, that it's like you don't find that out until you're older.
Yeah, I mean, why would
there was no reason for anyone to tell me that black people couldn't have had the priesthood, but you know, 12 years before I was born. Also, so there's a missionary that is named Elder Kinniger.
Yeah.
Who I think is probably the best performance.
Yes.
In the movie, who's the one who actually like is reading anti-Mormon literature, losing his faith, and presents two pretty common anti-Mormon points, which is horses in the Book of Mormon anachronistically, and that Joseph Smith gave these four different versions of his first vision, which vary dramatically on key details, like whether God was there or not. And to have those in a Mormon text, I cannot stress how subversive that is. There is nothing, anything that the church puts out is not going to talk about that, right? Like there's not, and God's Army in particular kickstarted for about 7 or 8 years, this cottage industry of Utah cinema, where like local businesses were bankrolling people to make Mormon movies. It ends up really coalescing around these guys that made sort of these really broad Chris Farley movie ripoffs called like The Singles Ward and The RM. And Dutcher, in any interview you read, reads these guys to filth. Because he basically is like, they took the concept of like the Mormon movie and turned it into something where like there's one coming out every week and it mostly sucks and it's mostly just inside jokes and like there's no like attempts to like interrogate anything. I do think that is like also probably one of the reasons why Dutcher kind of steps out is by the time he steps out, he's no longer in control of Mormon cinema. He's no longer the dominant force within the community that he had been. If he had been able to somehow maintain that and create three or four other Richard Dutchers that were also making these sort of like interrogations, and the Utah audience would still go to those, you know, maybe his faith journey looks a little different.
I mean, it's difficult to make non-one-dimensional characters, right? That's where this film succeeds, is that each character, one of maybe four, have various kinds of crises of faith or doubts at the very least, or certainly doubts about the mission and the importance of this and their purpose in life. And they're fleshed out in a way that's believable. Their struggles internally and the way that that, you know, Dutcher's character is basically there to bolster their faith and to keep the kind of mission on track. But he himself, right, has these, if not doubts, these kind of lagging questions about what his life is there for, right? He's dying of cancer and he's essentially refused. He's chosen a kind of martyr's death, right? In that he's going to continue the mission as opposed to returning to his family, which...
He's not allowed. That could never actually happen.
All of this is in service of what, right? It's in service of presumably either growing a community or a spiritual journey, both of which are going to be ended for him, right? He's not going to be able to return to wherever he came from and be with the family. That is the purpose of the faith. Or the spiritual growth that he's going to undertake is not worth it. So who's he there for? He's there for these people, right, that he's saving. And, you know... That's, I think, unique among the flock, ironically, right? That for everybody else, it's a story about kind of personal growth, either growing into their faith or growing as men, right? Whatever, you know, same as a film about, you know, going off to the army, right? Or a trek west, or, you know, going to college, yada, 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 right? These personal growth stories. And then when you carefully lay upon that a framework that is religious, you can make a compelling film about how religiosity breaks into that and to non-Mormons like myself, it can actually be compelling. You can watch this and say, that's probably how it is, right? And not only is it entertaining filmmaking, but from an outside perspective, I mean, I don't think these films are made for non-Mormons, but this is the most normalizing film for Mormon life that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
By far. Yeah. It takes those guys that come to your door and you're like, why the fuck are you bothering me? And puts a human face on them, which is rare.
Well, you know, like when I think the other thing is that like it reminds you that these are also like when they're not putting the face that the investigator sees, they're fucking around in their apartment. You know, like there was so like it when I was on my mission in Memphis, there was a house in Fraser, which is the rough part of Memphis, where pretty much exclusively like the dudes that had been on like the wrestling team and it from and Idaho Farm Boys got exclusively sent there. And they like had a room in their house where they like broke the air conditioner or the heater and threw a towel over it and created a sauna. They had another closet that they called the chokey, where the thing where like people would be visiting and they'd push you in there and they took out the doorknob and they would shoot fireworks at you. Like, I mean, like, it's like you're 19, you're 20, like, and you're away from your little community. I mean, the vast majority of missionaries are from Utah, Southern Idaho, Northern Arizona, Las Vegas, like, and a sizable amount from the varied places in California, right? But that it really is like most of you are coming from this very protected area, and then you're just like ripped out into the world in that way. And I think a lot of if you were to see other LDS depictions of missionaries, they are always entirely dutiful. They are always entirely obedient.
They're not
the
doing
idea
frat
that
house
disobedient
bullshit.
Missionary is haram. They don't talk about it, right?
They're not doing frat house bullshit the kind of way that young men invariably do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's honestly, and honestly, I think that's part of a personal growth story that probably should be shared more, at least if you're trying to normalize it to the outside world. If you're trying to make an accurate depiction, and two, make yourself seem like inculcated into a larger culture, it's important to say that, right?
Hearing what you have to say about like the reality of, you know, rambunctious boys on a mission, I would maybe this movie already exists, but I would love to see like a Mormon version of Animal House at like BYU or something. it just sounds like there's I don't know if anyone here is familiar with the Birthday Boys, which is a sketch group, but the very first sketch they have on their TV show is called Christian Mischief. And it's just like Christian pranks where they're buying like a bunch of eggs and you think they're gonna egg in house, but they just make scrambled eggs and eat like way too many eggs. It's like that kind of silly stuff.
If we don't get our conversion numbers up, the tabernacle's gonna shut us down. Yeah. No.
The Mormon version of that is because you can't drink, because you can't have sex, you're a little bit limited on the areas of the types of mischief that you can cause, which means a lot of that gets dialed up. in terms of like, oh, we're going to blow something up, or like, we're going to like, we're going to go 150 on the highway, or just like, you know, like that kind of stuff, risky behavior.
Awesome.
Which the more and more I think about it, the more I'm shocked that any of us make it out alive.
Just adrenaline junkies can't do it, be anything else. Well, I want to ask, when you were serving your mission in Memphis, did you face or did you encounter people experiencing these similar crises of faith?
Yes, a little bit. It's tough to be open when you're on your mission about your own faith stuff, like that you're going through. But it is also the first time in your life where you are literally thinking about nothing else but the church, which means that any sort of contradictions start getting really heightened in your mind. Like you're really reading everything, right? You're reading the, you know, the Doctrine and Covenants, which you're not really encouraged to read as a kid, which are all the list of the revelations that Joseph Smith had, 75% of which are Joseph Smith having a revelation that somebody needs to give him something, right? Like there's a lot of things where you like start having that like uneasiness, and you're getting pressure put on your faith from the other faiths that you're encountering. Particularly in the South, right? You're coming up against sort of the Southern Baptist. To Mormons, I think all evangelicals are under the banner of Baptist, right? But that, but you're referring to sort of like all of that. But you're coming like up against people like, you know, my understanding is Bellevue Baptist, which is the big mega church in Memphis. They have like, you know, weekday classes that you could take about like history study or, you know, biblical this or that. And one of them was like how to argue with Mormons, you know, defense against the Mormon missionaries.
Which is odd because, I mean, no offense to the Mormon missionaries and their attempts, but I can't imagine that this is very successful, at least in the United States, right? When the Mormon church and Americanism, especially like you could in foreign countries, can be associated with a kind of prosperity gospel message, and that can be met by people who will openly and readily accept it and who are, you know, potentially they're plugging into a network that could improve their lives noticeably. I just can't imagine that a lot of Americans are like, Jesus came to America? That's what the fuck? All right. Enough.
Well, where it grows, and you're right, that the baptisms are much higher in Africa and South America and outside of the United States. However, I think the real growth that happens in the United States is around social networks. So like where like the highest baptizing mission in the church by tradition, if not true, they don't release the numbers, but this is always what's said, is the Salt Lake mission, right? Like that it's like people come to Utah, they get ingratiated into the culture. Maybe they start dating someone who's in the church. Maybe their best friend is someone who's in the church who's like, hey, I really want you to come. They start coming to ward activities. They become a part of the culture. And then, you know, like the guy that in God's Army that's driving them around, right, where he's not baptized because he doesn't want to give up coffee. There's like, you know, especially all over the United States, there's a bunch of those guys because it's community.
The thing that it offers, and welcomed and inculcated into an existing communal form, right?
Exactly.
You start going to church with them and you are in, baby. It's, I mean, that is honestly for somebody who's, you know, essentially has very little faith and is earnestly, I mean, I'm not joking. I am jealous of those who do. That community is the dream. You tell me as, I don't know if you want to define yourself as a lapsed Mormon perhaps, but I would imagine is the thing that is missed most is being in the club, feeling as though you are a part of something that is, I mean, especially as somebody who's a-religious in the United States, is not readily present in the kind of standard fodder of life for Americans, right? People go to church, but that community is for Sundays, right? Or maybe you know their names, and when you see them at the grocery store, you say something. It's not totalizing.
On that, Alec, I do want to say, like, I've talked to you about this for a little bit this week, but, like, I was kind of snookered into joining the evangelical church that was in a strip mall in our suburb. The reason why I like went all in was because of the instant community I felt and the instant like friendships I had. And I mean, we can cut this if it's too much, but my senior year of high school, Alec joined a different club and I definitely like wanted more friends. And so like,
you became Christian,
I
became an evangelical.
I was Episcopalian. And I basically had a car accident that was like really, really bad that I walked away from with no injuries. And the preacher's daughter, who was a total smoke show, told me that it wasn't a coincidence. You were saved by God. I was like, okay. So I went to this church and I'm like, okay, everyone's really nice. Everyone's really fun. And they're not immediately talking to me about God all the time. And they invite me to go to Taco Bell and everyone's praying in Taco Bell. I'm like, okay, whatever. But I'm a part of it. And the reason why I left the church is two reasons. Is one, I went to church camp with them and everyone started talking in tongues. And I'm like, that's not what I signed up for. And then I smoked weed and got a bunch of kids high, which it was not their first time getting high. I should say that. But they ratted me out. And then I got kicked out of the church for being a corrupting influence. So I went to college right after that and made a lot more friends. But in any case, I bring this up to say, like, I know what you're talking about, Alec, that like instant community, it's like a drug. It is very, very intoxicating. But
if it shows how bad of a friend I was, Nate, I was not aware of this until yesterday night when we talked about it. I was like, what the fuck? You joined a church? And he's like, we weren't talking a lot back. You had a girlfriend and you were orchestra, like, we weren't hanging out that much.
Alec was having sex and I joined a charismatic church.
Which way, Western man?
The path of degeneracy.
So I also want to touch on this because, Nate, you and I know each other through the online community surrounding Matt Chrisman's Kush Vlogs. And something
peace be upon him.
Yes. But one thing I found very interesting in the Discord that you started for that community, there are so many lapsed religious people wanting community, and they try to bring that to their left-wing politics. And I think that's really fascinating.
Well, and I think also because, like, I think the track record a lot of times for the pipeline, you know, like, so for example, to this, when Brandon Johnson was running for mayor of Chicago, I live in Chicago now, I went to go canvass. There were like three other people there and we were just like kind of talking. I was like, yeah, you know, in Utah, it's really easy because the streets are all numbered. And they're like, you've been to Utah? I'm from Utah. And then the other one's like, I'm from Utah.
No way.
And we were all ex-Mormons that were like, canvassing for this like black borderline socialist at the time mayor. So I think there is a real path that people go down. And I think a lot of it is you lose your faith and you turn and say everything about that community was wrong and bad and stupid, and I'm going to go find my other people. A lot of times you latch on to a political track. There's a lot of people leave Mormonism, get into far right wing politics as well.
Yes.
So it's not just a left right thing, but you find yourself.
They don't have to leave the church for that one.
Yeah. You do not have to leave the church, as has been proven over and over again. I think what you find is like you start to see the leaders after you've been through a couple cycles of leftists like eating at each other. You start being like, okay, I think I actually know how to do what we say we want to do here and build like a community and build like a durable organization. And I think that is like one of the places where one of the reasons why I stopped calling myself ex-Mormon, started calling myself post-Mormon, was because I was like, well, I can look back on this and see a couple of things. So Alec, to go to your point about the community in Utah, my ward is the congregation that you attend every Sunday, which is assigned geographically. Not like you don't pick which one, you live in a ward. And in Utah, that was entirely coterminous with the concept of the ward and the concept of the neighborhood. So the 120, 150 houses closest to the one I grew up in, we all went to the same church. And so there were maybe five people in that neighborhood that weren't. But like still a lot of times came to the stuff, right? Like they'd be like Lutheran, but they'd still like come to like bowling night or whatever, so the kids could go in. And because of that, there's a really well-built youth program where you get a lot of the different adults in the ward or your like Sunday school teacher for a year, which then means you kind of have a bond with them your whole way up. So it's kind of like I was raised with an excess of grandparents and uncles and aunts that were really right around and really like did like care. And I think when people ask like, why are Mormons so friendly? There's kind of a three-part answer to that. The first one is, well, why are greeters at Walmart so friendly? because corporate has instructed them to do so, right? Like that's a little bit of that. The second part, the more earnest part is I think that there is a secure attachment if you grow up inside of a Mormon faith that like, you know, like we know that like kids that grow up with a lot of adult intervention and a lot of attention in that way tend to have sort of like better social skills and stuff. Like that's a benefit. And then I think the third thing, and I think is the way you see it in Brigham City, is this community is really on top of each other. Where like, if you happen to work with somebody in your ward, you would literally see them every single day of the week. Or even just like in general, where it's like 20 years of just like knowing these people and like really intimately, like going to the temple with them, like doing like really sacred rituals with your neighbors. And if that is going to work, and if that is not going to be sort of like combustive, everybody needs to have a pretty good veneer of politeness, right? Like you can't be like a bomb thrower, and you can't really tolerate bomb throwers too.
Right. The people that are going to survive in that community are going to go along to get along. Well, they're not like, going to be antagonistic.
I've been watching Deadwood. This is another thing where it's like, is this a Mormon thing or is this an American West thing? Is another aspect to it. But in Deadwood, they never come out and say anything that is negative information about a person that's not there, because you don't want to get caught talking shit. And so they develop like this very like second or this double talk language, which if you read about Brigham Young is like how that guy operated. Was everything was sort of layered in multiple levels of
plot. Subtweeting basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is a real aspect. And I don't know that you could say that's necessarily just the Mormon faith. Obviously it's a part of a larger American West and American experience too. And also I should say there are Mormons in Brazil that kind of have their own distinct culture. The most distinct one is of course in Polynesia, in Samoa and Tonga. So just early, it's basically the first place where Mormon missionaries have like a ton of success in a non-white place. They are able through in the Book of Mormon, because there's like a offside where there's like, so-and-so named Haygoth sailed west. There's like kind of a loose claim that the Polynesians might be the Nephites or
we found them.
Nephites, right? Like, well, I think that's more like Polynesians themselves read themselves into the faith as being like Manti Te'o. That was a very famous linebacker of controversial LDS, comes from a Mormon Samoan family. In fact, most of the Polynesian, not most, I shouldn't say most, probably about half of the Polynesian players in the NFL are LDS and come through BYU or Utah. There's a really strong pipeline there. Even people like Zach Wilson, the quarterback for, I guess, the Broncos now, but is like a fourth Tongan or whatever, has a Hawaiian middle name, right? It's very ingrained in there, but it also has a very different color to the culture, because inside of the United States, a lot of times there are just like Tongan and Samoan language wards that are not there because these people only speak Tongan or Samoan, but so that they can congregate culturally. And from everything I understand, it's kind of anything that you would say is stereotypically Mormon, the rules go out if you're talking about a Samoan ward, right? Or a Tongan ward, just because it's layering on top of an existing culture.
I mean, the things you talk about, talking about those tight-knit communities, and especially that cultural more about not directly antagonizing others publicly, I'd say is pretty well known as like a Southern meme, right? The like, bless your heart kind of secondary talk about, you know, unfortunate things that happen to people as opposed to, you know, them being clearly their fault or something, whenever you talk about somebody in those terms. And as well, right, like as a, you know, Connor jokes, but I'm a kind of revert, right? Like the family's from here, but I'm one generation removed. When you come back here, it's actually very difficult to break into these social networks. One, there's not a kind of communal openness about opening you up into the faith, right? So if you don't join a church, you're kind of out, because these people grew up together. Either they went to the same schools, they went to the same churches, or at least the relationships between schools and families have some cohesion. So two people from Lake Charles will meet and they'll say, what year are you? I went to St. Louis. I went to LaGrange. I went to Barb. My brother was in that year. Do you know X? Ah, and there's like a social connection there, and they're in, right? They're part of the in group. They talk to me. I say, I grew up in fucking, you know, the northwest side of Houston. Done. We're gone, right? Maybe they'll say, who are your family? oh, okay, I might know them, right? But basically, you're out. It's over, right? They have no common ground.
I think there is like a very similar thing I have found recently out in the big world. When I run across somebody who either is Mormon, progressive Mormon, which is like the Mormons who are like, I know all of the issues, but I am staying to help influence the church for good, or like Jack Morans or anyone who has that background, it's pretty much an instant like connection and friendship out here. And similarly, if you go back to Utah, there's like an organization where like if Alec, if we were to reverse this, instead of Lake Charles, you were in like actual Brigham City, Utah, like the word would find you. They would say this. And then like people would start running through your family tree and be like, oh, did your grandpa know my grandpa on there? Like there's just like there's an organization to facilitate people like you who like bounce in and out, or like the family was in Cincinnati for one generation and now they're back in Utah and like reintegrated really quickly. It's one of the things Mormons do really well.
So I wanted to ask real quick, when we were talking about Polynesian Mormons, and you know, this is also a Chicago connection, but I wanted to ask about Monte Teo. Are you all familiar with the story of Monte
Yes,
Teo?
I'm extremely familiar, and I will correct you, is Manti.
Manti Te'o, my mistake.
Tell the listeners.
That is a Book of Mormon. So Manti is a name from the Book of Mormon, and is also a small city in central Utah. Manti Te'o was, if not the top high school recruit in the country, one of those like top five guys. Comes from the Te'os in general are a big, within like Mormon football culture, a really big deal. His uncle created something called the All Poly Camp, which has like become this big like high school circuit. And he's the cream of the crop, in part because he was this really athletic linebacker, but in part because he had like this like dynamic leader-like personality. He goes to Punahou High School in Hawaii, which is where Obama went, rather than most of those guys come out of Kahuku High School, which is in Lai. I'm not good at Hawaiian pronunciations. I apologize. I know they are phonetic, and if I had it in front of me, I could take my time to say it.
Then I don't feel bad about you correcting my pronunciation.
There is a town in Hawaii, Laiea, where their temple is, where there's also a huge Mormon Polynesian population. His parents took him to the private school in Honolulu to be like, almost kind of like the beacon. Again, it's that Mormon exceptional young man that he like fits the T, where he's like clean living, you know, one assumes, right? And is really like honorable, like he's very coachable. He's considered to be a lock to go to USC or BYU. And on signing day, he surprises everyone and commits to go to Notre Dame, a school to that point that did not have a history of recruiting Polynesian players. He was very much a trailblazer in that. His senior year, he finishes second in the Heisman polls or in the Heisman vote. And then it comes out in part because he had had this, his grandmother and his girlfriend had died the same day. And then it comes out after the season that his girlfriend was not real, that it was somebody who he was talking to online. We now know it was somebody in within that American Samoan community who was struggling with their own transness and had created an alt online to talk to all these, mostly like these like really prestigious players within the community. And in my mind, kind of knowing, I don't want to say it because I don't know Manti Te'o personally. I was in the MTC with his cousin. So I did it before all of this went down.
Always a connection.
For the listeners, I just want to point out, when Nate mentioned that he knew Manti's cousin, a little impish grin flashed across his face. He seemed very proud of knowing.
Yeah, that's one of those things where it's like, I know so-and-so. who himself was a college football player as well. So I don't want to just diminish him by his relation to Manti Te'o. But the type of person that you kind of see in, especially around football and Mormonism, is this, when we were kids, we called them the God child, which it's like the guy who's the best athlete on the football team is also 100% like sexually pure. He either has like a girlfriend or he doesn't date and doesn't do locker room talk, doesn't drink, focuses only on sort of like football and academics. Like in my high school, it was a kid that ended up being Jimmer Fredette's backup at BYU. There's just this type of guy. I call them paladins, right? They're like kind of very like warrior monks. I think the Manti Te'o thing, now that we have this like come out, I think that it was probably an appeal to have an online girlfriend because there was no temptation that he was going to have sex with her.
Oh, interesting.
Which is not something he's put forward himself. He kind of recently did a documentary where they opened up about the whole story, because for a long time people thought he was in on the deception. But also one thing with that is he talks about how that situation destroyed him mentally, and he never could get back to being this guy who could outperform his own physical talents on the field through like heart and will and confidence, because he'd fundamentally like lost faith in himself. So he ends up being a middling linebacker in the NFL for 7 or 8 years, when it looked like he before that broke, he was looking like a first round pick, you know, future all pro.
I mean,
that is the tragedy of Manti Te'o.
Enormously embarrassing.
Things will come around for him, but
I don't know if I could imagine something as embarrassing as a young man in college, especially one that's like so high on a social totem pole. Because as soon as you said the internet girlfriend thing, I go, oh, I remember this. The catfish guy, the catfish football player. If you're that guy to every American in your generation and above and below, I would hide under a rock for probably the rest of my life. That's got to be brutal shit.
It definitely, I wanted to bring this up because it seems like there's a certain innocence and a naivete of Manti Te'o and Mormon culture as a whole that is really examined in Brigham City, which is the second film that we were looking at. Oh, yeah.
Before we move, I've got quite a bit more to say about God's Army, but we've been kind of dithering, and it's good conversation.
Let's get this God's Army.
Okay.
Let's do this thing.
My question to you, Nate, is how representative of we talked about mission life. We talked about the kind of fraternal order that that a mission probably creates and how people kind of come out of their shell probably, right? It's and a coming of age thing. How representative of the actual mission work is the film, right? And the purpose of mission work.
I would actually say it's very representative in the sense that most of it is getting doors slammed in your face, right? Or is knocking on doors and not getting answered. When you are talking to somebody, a lot of times your investigators do look a lot like Benny, where it's somebody who's been sort of like laid low due to one thing or the other. Pretty unusual. I would say unusual for anyone to heal, use the power of healing. I will say one thing it captures that I think is true and is very much a true thing of Mormonism is when Richard Dutcher's character is having his first seizure, there's like the guys that go to like hold him down. And then the other guys go to like anoint him and give him a blessing.
Right?
There is a very literal belief in that. And that I think is 100% true to that. Like
there's a big part. Mormons believe in faith healing, or it's a social belief,
a specific type of it. So it is a consecrated oil for health. And it's not even like a big part of Mormonism is it happens through the laying on of hands and blessings, right? So it's like your father every year gives you like a back to school blessing where he puts his hands on your head and he like finds the spirit and he tries to like speak to you. And it's genuinely a very like moving experience, right? There's a subset to that is that if you are unwell, there is a consecrated olive oil that is like blessed that is laid on the head. I think if any active Mormons are listening to this, mute it for 20 seconds. I think that this is probably a connection to sort of like the backwoods magic that Joseph Smith was involved in more than like your traditional, like, I don't know any Mormon who said that they've seen someone be healed, but you would always give that blessing. Like on my mission, right before I got there, an investigator's apartment caught fire. He escaped out and the missionaries were the first people to find him while the apartment was on fire. And one of them did, I think CPR, I can't remember. One of them took care of him medically and the other one consecrated or, you know, gave him the blessing. And that was like a joke in the mission over who actually saved his life, the one who gave the blessing. But we couldn't remember which one was which. And one of those missionaries was very popular and one was very unpopular. So whoever it was, we could reverse the logic on like, well, who's putting their faith in the arm of man there and trying to do CPR rather than blessing him? And then you find out it's the other guy and you're like, well, you know, obviously CPR is what saved him, right? The blessing is just there to coax out. So those are a couple of things I think really jumped out.
I mean, it's not at all unique, by the way. I mean, Catholics. Yeah. If you haven't heard, to be a saint, you have to perform miracles, and they meticulously write those down, and there's some reporting. And so, I mean, the belief is there, but as you say, right, like, have you personally witnessed a miracle? No, but, you know, my uncle one time, you know, they interacted with the saint, and I'm sure that happened, right?
Like, yeah, it's all it's not like the faith healers down, you know, not down south, they're everywhere, but like where it's like,
yeah, they're healing you, you're getting healed, and you're getting healed.
Yeah, Oral Roberts stuff, right? That I think most Mormons would look at that and be like, that's hokum, right? Like, that doesn't, I don't believe that for a second.
I just want to say that at that evangelical church I went to, I did witness a faith healing, not something where I'm like, I saw it happen. The pastor was just like, I feel God in this room tonight. I want some people to come up here so I can lay hands and bless them and heal them. And my youth pastor went up, and the guy laid his hands on him, and my youth pastor started crying, and he took his glasses off. He said, I had trouble seeing, and now I can see so clearly. And then, and I'm like, all right, whatever. And then for me, and this is a big thing of like why I left the church, or why I didn't feel bad about leaving the church, I'll put it that way. The pastor then said, all right, and for context, I'm missing an eardrum in my left ear. My hearing's kind of dog shit. But the pastor says, now, if anyone's ever had any kind of physical pain, I want you to stand up. I was like, okay. So like anybody can stand up. Even I'm a little skeptical on that. He goes, actually, if you've ever had trouble with your hearing, I want you to stand up. Everyone sit down. Only if you've had trouble with your hearing, stand up. And I was just like, holy shit, this guy's got the word of God in him. So I stood up, and everyone in the room rushed and laid their hands on me and started talking in tongues. And I was like, holy fucking hell, I'm going to die here. And I ended up calling my dad that night. I was like, Dad, I need you to come pick me up from camp. I need you to come pick me up. And he just said, every time you go to camp, you want to be picked up, but then by the end of it, you don't want to leave. I'm not coming to get you. And he hung up. I was like, no, I'm going to die in Jesus camp. But yeah, so I think faith healing is a bunch of bunk.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah.
Yep.
But so the reason, Nate, I asked that is, upon some reflection, my presumption is that missionary work is largely about self-inculcation, right? That essentially the purpose of going on these missions is to define the faith in the individual, right? As a kind of trial by fire, a rite of passage. And critically, in the United States, at the very least, exposure and direct conflict with a fallen world, I'd call it. I'm not sure how Mormons would refer to it. Especially in this movie, to go to L.A., right?
They can't use Las Vegas because Las Vegas is already.
They can't use Las Vegas because it's full of Mormons, right? Like, to go to some den of sodomy, right? Some Gomorrah, and to come into contact with these fallen peoples, right? These people that you're trying to help, and to have them refuse you and to say, it's not just about a spiritual conflict that you're having with them. It's defining of you. It's going to put into perspective the place you came from, the community you came from, and say, wow, I value my upbringing in Brigham City, in Provo, in somewhere else, because there's no fucking prostitutes on the street, right? There's no homeless people. There's no angry drunks on their lawn, or whatever God's army depicts and whatever those people encounter, which are, you know, by and large, some version of normalcy for Americans that they're not going to come into contact with maybe otherwise if they stay there, and would be lacking the zeal, right, to reaffirm a kind of faith and a kind of communalism by rejecting.
Yeah, I would say like the diseases of modernity, right, like where it's like that are somewhat absent because of the communal structure inside of Utah, right? Like, not, which is not to say that there is not a homeless population in Utah. They just push it all into Salt Lake, right? But the just as like a little like history background, right? I think understanding Mormonism, you need to understand that there is, especially like the Brighamite, the ones that followed Brigham Young after the end of the faith, between 1847 and 1869, two things are happening. One is missionaries like Wilford Woodruff and Dan Jones and these guys who have statues of them at BYU, at the MTC, are baptizing thousands of people in the British Isles and Denmark. and a little bit into the other Scandinavian countries, and bringing them over across the plains to where they get to Utah, which from 1847 to 1869 is a police state run by Brigham Young. The in and out, the only way you can get really in and out of Utah without Brigham Young knowing about it is sneaking through out with the army as they pass through, right? Transcontinental Railroad comes through and really like weakens the control of the faith. Also, they become much more associated with polygamy. People think that's weird. And up until 1890, Wilford Woodruff, a name that's going to come back later, basically says, we're not going to do polygamy anymore. But then they secretly do it for another like 20 years. There's congressional hearings about it over whether they can seat a Mormon as a senator. Then by the time you get to the 1930s, the church has lost a lot of faith inside of the state of Utah. The president of the church, Heber J. Grant, took out full-page ads in the Deseret News saying, do not vote for Franklin Roosevelt. If you do, your faith is in question, because this is an evil. And FDR carried Utah in a landslide 4 years, all four times.
Now, just out of curiosity, what was the connection between a faithlessness and Delano Roosevelt? What are the policies?
Socialism.
Okay. So just
the leaders of the church usually come from the upper class of Utah society. Heber J. Grant was a banker before he got into the leadership. And also, it very much was a faith that had dropped at that point, right? 1929 is when the FLDS church comes into being and pulls a big middle class, not a large number, but probably a lot of people who functionally were very important in the operation of the church out of it. And the church basically rebrands around a kind of discarded doctrine from Joseph Smith's time called the Word of Wisdom, which is no drinking alcohol, no smoking tobacco, no coffee. That had not been enforced previously.
The hot beverage thing is actually a later addition, right? It's not.
It is the hot beverage. So he says hot drinks. That's what he says in the. It came during a temperance movement in the 1830s. Where coffee, it's the one where coffee was getting lumped in with alcohol as like something that we needed to go. So he said hot drinks, he definitely meant coffee. Mormons can drink hot chocolate and they can drink cold caffeine.
yeah, because they love sodas.
Yeah. So the one thing in Brigham City, because my wife saw it, was really impressed by it. The one thing is when they're all like drinking out of mugs, she's like, what are they drinking? They're not drinking coffee. And in reality, and I think that this was a smart change, in reality, they would be chugging Mountain Dew and Diet Coke. But that would look incongruous for them to be like, we need to find this killer. Let me down this fluorescent green liquid.
Are Mormons big into Dr. Pepper, or is that just a...
All of it. Because my grandfather...
Is there a Mormon soda?
Out of bed and drink a Mountain Dew, which feels insane to me, but that is why like Utah... Every time I'm back in Utah, I can't adjust to how fucking sweet all of the food is. It's so just like over. Anyway, so they rebrand specifically under the guys or under the leadership, first as sort of like a high-ranking official and then eventually as the president of the church, David O. McKay. That's when Mormons shave their beards. That's when we become like very much about clean living. We are in the post-war era now. There's that religiosity that's coming out. And that is when they start sending out the boys at 19. That's when it becomes a requirement. Previously, the church had to ask you to go on a mission. So they would be like, one of my grandfathers was born in 1890, great grandfather was born in 1890. He's 23. He's unmarried. His dad is kind of a bigwig in Logan. Gets a letter from the church. Hey, we want you to go to Germany. So he goes, flies, learns Germany there, and is there when World War I breaks out. As a Mormon missionary, and at that point decides to come home. But in his journals, talks about being like, there was like no military, and all of a sudden it was like they were hiding it underneath the street, and all of a sudden you saw the militarization. Anyway, that's when it becomes every Mormon boy serves, and I think the missionary effort makes the church stronger in Utah, because suddenly you need to go to church because your boys need to go to church because they need to be prepared to go on a mission to go preach the gospel abroad. And you can see there are two really big, as far as it can be measured, two really big upticks in activity rates amongst Mormons. One in 1950, which is when they start this missionary effort, and one in 1970 when they start this thing called Correlation, which is every church, every Sunday, throughout the world is teaching the same lesson out of the same book, right? Like they really rein in, like they put like this like real control on like the doctrine in around 6970. And that in itself helps because there are like Mormon people that believe Bigfoot is Cain. Like that is like that is a in church doctrine that is in a book written by a Mormon prophet. That, right, like, so there's like a lot of things that are very like out there and weird. And correlation is about like pushing all of that weirdness down.
That's fascinating that it's not centralized enough to have like the Catholic missile. You go in your book and that's the day. And that's what we're doing today. Right.
I mean, they basically do. I mean, it's a little bit more hidden. It's not as like up on that. Mm. And so basically from like 1950 to the time of God's army, the church is like, this is when like Mormon church is the fastest growing church in the world, you know, like growing like gangbusters. It's leading up to the 2002 Salt Lake Olympics, which is a big deal for the church. That it's like the world is coming to the mountains. There's also with the Winter Olympics, where most Mormons are introduced to Mitt Romney, the first time I'd heard of him back in like 2000, it was like, this guy is going to be the first Mormon president. And there's a extant, probably not real, prophecy from Joseph Smith that there was going to be a Mormon president that holds the Constitution together. So there was like a lot of momentum that kind of a wave that crests and crashes in November of 2012 when Romney loses. I think that you start to see, and the past decade of the church has been mass defection. Like that there's, I would guess just basing on like eyeball ballpark, how many people I know that have left, what I'm hearing based on consolidation of wards, the church has probably lost about 20% of its active going people from 2012.
A very good friend of mine has a bunch of family members in the church still, or I guess maybe post. And he's told me that is basically the quiet, unacknowledged truth is that American Mormonism is in crisis. So in God's army, you get that feeling, right? That there are going to be crises of faith, especially with contact with the outside world. But my guess is probably internally as well, right? You could stay in Provo and kind of grow away from the church or read the wrong thing and be naturally kind of alienated from it. And to have that alienation, to have those crises of faith happen in a controlled way, as opposed to a non-controlled way, in a way that might be more attentive or nurturing, or where it may in fact be considered normal. I mean, I'm projecting here. I'm just wondering.
Yeah.
Right. That seems to me like, I mean, maybe they accidentally fell into this, but quite a clever construct for a religious and social order, right? They were going to have a controlled contact with this outside world that could break your faith or your relationship to us.
I think it is unquestionable that the thing that is the most indicative over whether someone born in the church stays in the church is whether they go on a mission. Like, I think, and really? I think they would tell you that's like, that was a huge part. I waited almost a year after I turned 19 to go because I really didn't want to go because it seemed really hard. I was not a spiritual giant at that point. yeah. A part of the reason why everyone wants you to go is like, just go and you'll figure it out there. Like you'll go and you'll come back with a testimony. And I think that's like kind of true. But like for me, a lot more of the way it affected me was that I saw so much poverty. And I was Spanish speaking, so I was mostly helping people that are in the absolute like Kafka-esque nightmare that is the American immigration system. And I came home like really radicalized about that, energized about that, which in the end, kind of a lot of my path out of the church was like, why is the church opining over gay marriage when they're sending me to go convert undocumented immigrants and we're not doing anything for them? But also I will note one of the things, the only thing that really broke the real unanimous hold that the Republican Party's had in Utah is Trump. And it's largely believed because there's so many return missionaries that are not, there's not the same, like there is xenophobia in Utah. Like there's that, but as an overall level, Utah, I would say is probably much less xenophobic than like Montana, you know, or a state that's similarly or anywhere in the South. Because people are like, I went to Mexico on my mission. I mean, like 1 in 7 missionaries go to Mexico. And then there's all the people that were like me that were like mostly teaching Mexicans in the United States, right? Or Mexican nationals in the United States. So I think that also has created a bit of crisis for the church in this era. is the church has not been able to answer the challenge of Trump in a way that satisfies either side. And it's slowly driving everyone insane. Tim Ballard, I think, is kind of the lightning rod figure of that.
Fascinating that he keeps.
There was, I think, about a 10-day period in between when the church denounced Tim Ballard last summer and when we found out why they denounced him, where it looked like Tim Ballard and Glenn Beck were about to start a schism religion.
Jesus Christ.
And there is a real taste for that. If you see some of the true crime stuff that's going on in Utah, there are people that want the church to be more prophetic and less corporate than it is now, especially on the right flank of the church.
Interesting.
Let's pause these conversations about internal contradiction, because once we do, there's going to be a perfect time for a wrap up, because the synthesis of these two films is very striking. It's what makes them good choices.
Oh, I just had one quick question about your mission, Nate. Can you tell us your conversion rate?
Is
that rude?
I'm a little fuzzy because there's a thing where it's like, I can't remember exactly the number, but it was somewhere between like 23 and 26.
Nice.
And to compare, like my brother was in McAllen, Texas. He baptized, I think, 10 people. My brother-in-law went to South Korea and he baptized like 4 people. My dad went to Mexico and he baptized like 75 people. So there's in that ballpark. So there is a thing where it's like but also like one thing is like that is underrated, because like the Book of Mormon a lot of times gets criticized, and rightly so, as being pretty racist towards Native Americans, because it's like, you were the evil people that killed your white brothers. But a lot of times within the Mexican church, like they're like, hey, we're descended from like the Lamanites, which means we're descended from Joseph of Egypt, and like we have all these, and there are some Lamanite heroes in the Book of Mormon, and they really like Sandoval in God's Army, he starts going like, I'm Sandoval the Lamanite. That is a reference to a thing in the Book of Mormon where Samuel the Lamanite stands up on a wall to preach to the Nephites to repent, and they try to shoot arrows at him and no one can hit him. So that's why they start throwing stuff at him, is he's calling forward the thing. So
that would be, if Alec and I saw this in theaters with a bunch of Mormons and they all start laughing, we'd be like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah,
honestly, it is probably a good thing you did not watch this with Mormons, because you would have felt much more lost.
Okay, you guys want to pivot to God? Yeah.
I have to piss, so
yeah, let's take it.
Let's take a, you want to take a 5-10 minute?
Yeah, I'm gonna go grab break. Some re-up my coffee.
Okay, let's take a 5.
My hot drinks.
Take a 5? Okay.
Yep.
So that was the first half of our discussion with Nate Smith about Mormonism and the film God's Army. And in a couple days, you guys should be getting the second half of that. As always, send us an email if you'd like at propagandospod@gmail.com. I think we have a Twitter account and an Instagram thing too, but that's Connor's deal. I don't really know. So give us a follow if you liked it. Thanks a lot. Bye.